Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series.
Hello, my name is Sophie Black. I'm a writer, editor, and the head of special projects at the Wheeler Centre. Welcome to Melbourne Writers Festival, wherever you're tuning in from. Before we kick off, I'd like to acknowledge that today I am speaking on the lands of the Wathaurong people. I pay respects to their elders and to the elders of all communities and cultures across Victoria. This land was never ceded. MWF Digital brings some of the world's most essential literary voices into your home. From Pulitzer Prize winners to debut authors to the most talked about novelists of the year. In this session, I'm here to speak to an author who it seems is never not talked about year after year, Rachel Cusk. Rachel's Outline trilogy was heralded as nothing short of a reinvention of the novel. A prolific author of both fiction and non-fiction works, such as Aftermath and A Life's Work, Rachel's newest novel, Second Place, extends the themes of female fate and male privilege to encompass the murky link between art and evil. Rachel, given that you are so good at evoking interiors in your writing and none of us can be in the same room right now, can you indulge us a little and just paint a picture of where you are so we can feel a bit closer?
I'm in a street in North London, which I suppose at certain times in my life I've felt was in some strange way the kind of kernel of civilization, in that it was sort of normal life with liberal values or something. Anyway, it doesn't feel like that anymore. this country and this city feel much more sort of on the edge ideologically and embattled. So, and that's a sort of palpable thing walking around. But yeah, I've moved to Paris almost for that reason, and so coming back is a rather strange experience.
Interesting. It doesn't actually, that environment doesn't sound far from where we're all at the moment either. But turning to this new novel, Second Place, it's your first novel after the Outline trilogy. Where do you possibly go after being credited with reinventing the novel? How do you even overcome that kind of talk and get work up the courage to write that next novel?
I've never paid very much attention to what people say or write about my work, partly because I'm so bad at kind of technology and I don't think I would know how to find the various things people said, even if I wanted to. I think it's more where it left me as an artist, having done that work, having found a way to express some things that I thought were, that seemed to me when I began to be beyond expression. And which is not, you know, to say that I was better at using words than other people. It was almost a sort of psychological leap that required me to be incredibly accurately honest about sort of what this state of existence was that I felt could not be turned into a literary work. And, you know, so really that was actually a very kind of personal, first of all, a bit of an ordeal and then an amazing sort of transformational experience that to me didn't really relate much to what other people were doing with their novels. And I think that, you know, the problem was that at the end of it, I actually almost couldn't read anything anymore. And simply because I felt I'd sort of gone somewhere where there was no coming back from. So the idea of sort of going back into, I suppose, narratives and forms that essentially I had definitively left and proved to myself the reasons why. So it was more that problem of like, why would I ever want to write anything again? What could that possibly be? So I was very happy and relieved, I guess, that suddenly this book roared across my horizon and I thought, okay, that, you know, I'll follow that. That's something I can do.
And the thing that you, or the book that you followed or inspired you is actually the 1932 memoir of someone called Mabel. Can you tell us a little bit about Mabel?
So, I'm very much in kind of two minds. I usually don't sort of say anything in or put any explanation in a text that I write. And this time I sort of hummed and hawed about it. And now I'm still humming and hawing and not knowing whether it was the right thing to do, because having put this information in the book that it owed a debt to this other book, in a sense, for me, a little too much has been kind of made of that, because I'm not sure that it's particularly a route to anyone else understanding the book. I mean, I guess I thought, as I always think when I write something, this is really weird and no one's ever going to understand it. And in this case, I kind of thought it might help to situate it for the reader. But in fact, my sort of artistic purpose in using this book, which was written by Mabel Dodge Lujan, who was a sort of early, a pioneer in lots of respects, and she had a sort of vision of creating an artistic colony, a sort of utopia where writers and artists could, you know, be free of society and create and associate with each other, which of course any sensible person would think that's a really bad idea. They won't get on, and in fact that is pretty much what happened. But what I realized, and I mean famously she was obsessed with D.H. Lawrence and very determined to bring him all the way to Taos, New Mexico, which is the landscape that she envisaged this wonderful communication taking place. And really the whole story was a story of her her will, her strong-willedness, which Lawrence absolutely couldn't bear. And yet it pulled him all the way across the ocean and got him to Taos. And so her memoir is a memoir of that and of her relationship with him. And what is so striking about it is that her voice really is the voice of lost female creativity, lost or lack of female creative authority. And, you know, that was happening, you know, that sort of shift in the 1930s was happening all across the arts. You know, this sort of female silence gradually being sort of pushed against. And I just found in her book this amazing artifact of the female voice, I guess. And that was the idea of these texts being neglected or abandoned, like sort of abandoned houses. And I thought, okay, I'll go and live in this abandoned house and I'll create something there. And that also seemed to me a response to the sort of formlessness, I guess, to my mind, the formlessness and sprawl of contemporary narrative literature, which just sprawls and sprawls and sprawls. And so I thought, okay, I'm not going to encroach on silence anymore. I'm going to go back and live in something that already exists. So that was a kind of weird sort of
almost
environmental
like you're restoring
idea.
Yeah, like restoring a building or recycling or some sort of like
that's how
the contemporary eco approach to to your next book.
So I mean the use of the book was really structural and really helpful for me to feel a connection with a different kind of connection with, I suppose, a female ancestry, because, you know, one of the problems, you know, sustaining oneself as a woman artist, and I mean, I've been writing for amazingly 30 years or something, is this feeling of you have no parents, you have no family, you have, you know, there's no one back there, you know, to plot your course by. And I mean, there are obviously people, but in terms of experimentation and sort of freedom. It's all those issues together.
It's so interesting in that it was a device that sort of opened a door in your mind, if nothing else. It's interesting that you say that you're kind of in two minds about you know, even acknowledging it. And it's not until the very end of the book that you read it, and you in no way need to read Mabel's memoirs to sort of appreciate or understand the book Second Place. But it is so interesting, because as opposed to the sort of almost invisible narrator of Faye in the Outline trilogy, this narrator, although she's nameless, she's very much present. So right down to her very many exclamation marks. She's very self-deprecating. She's actually scathing about herself. But she also demands to be seen, doesn't she?
Mm. Well, I mean, the other, I suppose, very, very striking thing for me in you know, finding out a little bit about her, Mabel Dodge Lujan, this my doppelganger, was how I mean, you know, I'm a bit of an amateur Lawrence scholar, and I didn't really know anything about this relationship. It isn't particularly mentioned in the sort of biographical research about him. And in fact, when I went back and looked, I saw a pretty concerted campaign to sort of calumnize this woman. And every time she's mentioned by any Lawrence biographer, it's with, you know, the utmost disgust and scorn. Mm. And sort of looking around a bit more sort of into her sort of life and status and relationships, I really saw something I absolutely recognized as something that had indeed happened to me very often. It was the same tone. It was the sort of violent desire to shut up the honest woman, mm-hmm. and to mute or suffocate her, and if not to almost in a sort of witch hunt type of way, to publicly condemn her. And I mean, you know, I've had periods in my life where, you know, I've written about such things as motherhood that are publicly very, very sort of ambiguous subjects. And so, you know, I've come in to the firing line for that. And so it was amazing to recognize this exact same tone. I thought, wow, you know, I thought I was the only person people used that tone with, but in fact, you know, it was you know, very, very evident there. So that voice, I suppose I felt that, you know, my strategy in the trilogy, which had been, okay, it doesn't work. It almost doesn't work there being an author of a book, because the desire, the minute you challenge people's sense of truth, of reality, of you know, of their subjective world, if they want to resist that, they'll immediately personalize it and say, well, it's only because she, you know, thinks this particular thing and I don't think that. And you know, in the trilogy, I thought, as I say, well, actually, it would be better if there was not even an author's name on this book, because, you know, the tendency to do that is so sort of automatic. And so this time I really wanted to, I suppose, in a less provocative way, to reinvestigate a little bit that idea of sort of a voice that is owned by a woman, that you know, people can use to vent their I don't know, resistance or annoyance, or, you know, in reaction to her. And yet it felt like, because she was a mask for me in this book, I sort of managed to do that without being, yeah, as terribly worried about these things as I have been in the past.
And she very much rails against this sense of invisibility, this invisibility that is imposed on her by Elle, the artist, by her daughter, as only sort of adult-aged children can do to mothers, a range of people. But she also sort of, she demands to be recognized by this artist. So not so much through her own means, but his paintings speak to her. They say, I am here. And it seems to be just as much around this comment of, she doesn't, it's like she needs to be legitimized by Elle, the artist, still through that male gaze in some way. She demands to be painted.
Well, I mean, we're really sort of back to, I guess, the kind of Chekhov Three Sisters idea of femininity as essentially a state of suppressed creativity or sort of non-authored creativity. And I mean, that's something I've written about quite a lot. But I guess kind of moving into middle age, I'm in my 50s, and so the landscape that I'm seeing is very much post female role models, female, you know, motherhood, children, domesticity, marriage, whatever, you know, and the politics of all those things, you know, I've written about pretty extensively. But suddenly this empty space of after those biological roles and social roles have been fulfilled, it seemed to me this question of sort of creativity, authorship, and status suddenly kind of looms up again. And you know, the question of am I the author? Am I, this woman, the author of my own life? Or have I, in fact, been, in a sense, a vessel for life to kind of pass through me and to take root elsewhere? And also, who am I? You know, what am I meant to do? Am I just an obsolete being who just has to sort of mark time, you know? So I think all of those issues are really interesting, and also the problem of how society, I suppose, values women once they've served their purpose, as it were. So in my book, you know, the narrator is at exactly that threshold of, and she talks a lot about wanting to be a creator, but remaining, because she doesn't, you know, there's nothing else she can do, remaining a devourer, remaining a person who subsists off the art and creativity and expression of others, and so much of that creativity being the consequence of a male freedom that she, looking back on her life, realizes was the privilege given at birth, the fairy over the cradle at birth, you know, that resulted in, you know, two completely different ways of living. So in the idea of this painter and of her sort of will of the woman being able to, even if she can't do things herself, being able to kind of make other people do them or sort of make things happen in some sort of passive almost way, the idea that he would paint her, that she would, is a very, I mean, it is her, and you sort of know that from the beginning, that it's a very bad idea, or not, that she's not going to get what she wants out of this person. So.
And she very much rails against that, which is, yeah, it's so interesting to read that in this narrator. She asserts her presence, whether it's amenable or not, or likable or not. It's sort of exhilarating to read that kind of behavior coming from a middle-aged woman.
Well, I think there's, I mean, I, you know, it's not something that I even have felt liberated enough to sort of do or be, but it's this idea of not, almost not caring anymore, or of realizing that you are your own imprisoner in a sense, and as I say, this rather kind of blank terrain of female middle age. You know, I think that it's a place where women have, I mean, there've been numerous kind of wild reactions to that idea in, you know, feminism, for instance, or in this idea of sort of, you know, not caring anymore what anybody thinks or, and I guess I'm kind of less interested in that response and more interested in a really structural inquiry, as to what femininity is in this later part of life. And I guess some of her, you know, it's anger rather than disinhibition. She's not being a crazy person. She's really, really, really wanting the answer. She's wanting to know why her life, you know, has been so different from this person's life. And of course, you know, there's a revaluing in that of the things that she actually has done, of her marriage, of her child, of, you know, the home that she's built, compared to his, the artist's totally amoral, selfish, and in the end, sort of catastrophically dangerous way of living, which, you know, his, the following of his own desires leads him to disaster. So I guess there's that idea of returning to appreciate a female discipline is quite, you know, that's quite a sort of important realization, I guess, that happens in the book.
Now, you don't name it explicitly, but this book is extremely 2020. You write, no, it's so 2020. How do you begin to write about the time that we are currently living through, or to even hint at it without descending into cliche, or how do you approach
that? Oddly enough, I began Second Place before the pandemic. Right. So it is incredibly coincidental that the two worlds mirror one another. I think what I thought was that the novel of the future would have to be outside the old realities of convenience and I suppose individual empowerment that I guess I felt were already disintegrating or becoming unfeasible, and that politics was becoming unfeasible, travel was becoming unfeasible, possibly nationhood, the whole idea of nations and identities and cultures was fading and sort of coming apart at the seams. And so it seemed to me that those were the correct conditions to, you know, to set That's a book great. In a world where, you know, you can't assume anything. You can't assume, you know, that people are even really communicating properly. And so, yeah, it then became very odd because I was absolutely in the writing of the book when this new state of affairs became our reality. And it was a very strange thing because I think everybody learned new things about their country and the people they live among in the reactions, the very first reactions. And in the UK, because we were here then, there was this amazing reaction from the elderly who were really strangely at the very beginning overjoyed at the whole world being put into what they considered their own living conditions, that suddenly people weren't having fun, they weren't free, they weren't, and so there was this very odd reaction from, as I say, the elderly, of like, now you know what it's like to be us. And for me, and I think probably quite a few other artists, there was almost a similar, this is how I live all the time. I am always sort of shut off from other people so it really almost overwhelmingly at the beginning, before it became obvious, you know, what this actually was and was going to become. But the very first few weeks of just things being shut down, it felt like such an incredible almost teletransportation experience back to being a very young writer, an unpublished writer, and simply having myself in a silence and deciding to create something. And so that was very, very helpful for me in terms of writing the book. It was a very joyful writing experience that I had with that feeling of the world having gone away. And of course, you know, there's nothing joyful that I would claim about this other than that, except perhaps reading and writing have become more fundamental to people. Mm. Maybe that way of communicating has regained some value, you know, which is something. I don't know if that's true.
The landscape is also a huge part of this book. Is it based in the area that you were in when you were writing the book?
It's a kind of melange of landscapes I have known in my life, as so much of this book is a funny collage, I guess. But yeah, I mean, in the circumstance of lockdown that we were just talking about, that feeling of being, I suppose, kept in a landscape which was the landscape, a coastal landscape here that I love very much, but that almost needing to communicate with it, needing it to be my world, gave me a. I mean, I've always had very, very strong feelings about it and have described it a few times, but it helped me, and I think perhaps one experience that a lot of people have had in the pandemic is thinking, okay, what in my life have I put a lot of effort into, but perhaps not expected to be supported by? And you know, for me, writing was definitely that. I never expected what I do to come back and help me or support me, but it really did in writing Second Place. I felt that I was being got through the experience by what I do. And
you mean in a type of almost like a therapy kind of way? Did it preserve your sanity? How did it help you?
It was sustaining. It was a solid sustaining thing. And you know, it's not as though a body of written work is intangible exactly, but I suppose I've always felt that everything lay in the future, that it all depended on me being able to continue doing this and continue perceiving and expressing, you know, the result of what I've perceived, and especially, as I say, to go back to what I was talking about at the beginning, this feeling of femininity and the female voice having this very uncertain status in culture, and to suddenly think, okay, well, I've here's my island, you know, it's the island I've made out of you know, my work, and you know, the waters might be rising, but I have this place to stand, and so that was interesting. It was a good feeling.
The narrator M is very much sort of adjacent to this male artist and this male art. And I think you've said in the past that you were struck by Mabel's diary as an account of a lack of female centrality. A lot has been made of the fact, you know, in the years since this so-called Me Too conversation has kicked off, that the lens is starting to shift. And no longer do women have to sort of subsume or just swallow the male viewpoint as this sort of fixed neutral point or the standard, the fallback kind of point of view. Do you think that's true at all? Do you think that's overstated?
Well, I think it's actually an almost entirely personal problem in that some people are more effectively convinced by a male-created reality than others. And if you're right on day one of your life, you know, enabled to be in a position where you question that as a girl and as a woman, you're going to get a lot further towards, I suppose, you know, believing in a female point of view than somebody who for whom these problems are, you know, absolutely part of their structural sense of what reality is, what culture is, what you know, society is. You know, I always used to use as an example the little sort of frisson of uncertainty that goes through the passengers on an airline when they realize the pilot's a woman. Okay. And that being a pretty generational, you know, for I think a girl, a 20-year-old girl, she might think, thank God, I'm much safer if the plane's being by a woman. The 65-year-old man, on the other hand, you know, possibly don't, well, the older man doesn't think that. So so I think that journey, how long it might take a female person to trust and believe in female authority. You know, I was brought up very conventionally, powerfully imprinted with the knowledge that men were superior, that being born a girl was, you know, a bit of a disappointment. It's taken me much longer to really, really, I suppose, dismantle and sort of free myself from that feeling of what, as I say, what reality is. And I think particularly, I mean, for me, it's a thing that started very much, I guess, kind of predictably with reading and finding my compass and my sense of trust and need shifting away from the dead male authors who I had, I guess, built, you know, my artistic practice on, you know, their examples, and gradually finding that I could no longer read them. And with a couple of honourable exceptions, but and that more and more and more, I wanted to read the writing of women, and that now is an extremely true thing about my own reading and general outlook.
You came to a point in terms of being brave enough to try out your own voice. You came to, well, you were published at a relatively very early age. I think you wrote Saving Agnes at 22 or 23, is that right? Mm, I mean, that requires not just a level of bravery, but an enormous level of self-discipline, especially for that age. Why did you do it and how did you do it?
Why did I do it? I suppose it's the only thing that I've never thought, why am I doing this? I think I did it because I didn't ask that question of why and was it the right thing to do? And I had a powerful, I think I didn't know that you could even have a book published when I first wrote a book. I knew that there was a literature that I read and loved, but I never related it to anything that was being done now or being done by someone like me it was a primary need, a mode of living that I, you know, at that period of life when, you know, I'd left university and a lot of people I knew were entering adult reality, entering, you know, the world of jobs, taking their place in society. And I think that was the moment when I thought, I can't do that. I need to get right what's already happened before I go on and do something else. So I think that feeling of wanting to stop and get the record straight was the first. It's something that I've seen so much in you know, particularly the years that I spent teaching creative writing, as it's called. You know, I never felt that people, or, you know, with a few rare exceptions, that the people I taught were you know, kind of unbendingly ambitious to sort of see their name in print and be a famous author, and they had a much more sort of delicate scruple, which was indeed my own, which was, why is what I think and what I know to be true different from what I see and what other people say has happened. And it's that, and I think that really is the creative impulse, is trying to align your inside with the outside and find somewhere mediated that is somewhere between those two things. So I think I felt that very, I mean, particularly having had a childhood in which the official version of, you know, very Catholic conservative family, you know, was very, very different from the reality of growing up as a young woman. And you know, one, people of my generation have very often had very little help from their mothers in that your mother is someone who promulgates the official male version, I guess, of what's important and what reality is and what's happening and who you are. And so I think that need to align those two things was particularly powerful in me.
Did that first book help sort of set you on that path and help you start to explore that thinking? Did you have a sense of completion by the end of that, or was it just that you got a taste?
Well, I'm glad I didn't know how many more books I was going to have to write to get to the bottom of it. No, I mean, it was the beginning of, it was the foundations of what has, you know, as I say, had to become a pretty big building. And the feeling that I had an existence that was not predefined by either my family or society, or that, you know, that was coming from where I came from, a big discovery that I think, you know, maybe I've been of use to other people, who not possibly very few of whom have suffered an absence of identity in quite the way that I have. But as I've passed through and I've stuck very close to life for that reason, not because I think I'm important or care particularly what happens to me, but because I think my usefulness lies precisely in that, in being able to sort of do this thing over and over again at each stage of life and say, okay, where am I? What is this? And who, you know, what kind of person am I? Is anybody, you know, in this experience of motherhood, in this experience of marriage, in this experience of divorce, of being and non-being, of having an object value as a woman and then suddenly not having an object value as a woman, you know, I guess my task has felt like a duty to try to interrogate those things and make them create reflections for other people to help to make them go, oh yeah, okay. That in these very confusing, you know, waymarks on the road of being a woman.
That first book, I know you say you don't read reviews, but it got very good reviews, especially for a first book. Did you feel of use? Did that feel, I mean, what did that feel like to have that sort of immediate success?
With that, I mean, unfortunately, it was pretty destabilizing, I guess, because, you know, the whole being the type of person who would write that book, i.e. a person who didn't think they were very important, and to then be treated as very important at a very young age. And I did everything everybody asked me to do. I did, you know, if someone had asked me to go and jump through a hoop at the circus, I would have done that. You know, I thought that was what you had to do. If someone asked you to do something, you had to do it. So I think I got led along into the sort of public or publicity based side of all of this, which it's taken me a long time to sort of withdraw myself from that and to realize that actually, you know, my lack of a public identity is really important to me. Partly because, you know, I've written so much about what appeared to be extremely personal experiences that you know, almost that creates an impression of a public existence that is not at all the reality. And so I've had to kind of joust with that a little bit as well. I think, I mean, any person who writes a novel out of nowhere and then sees, you know, a review of it in a newspaper or wherever is going to get a powerful impression of themselves. It's a powerful bit of reflection, for good or ill. Yeah.
Well, you were treated to a powerful bit of reflection after you wrote A Life's Work, your account of motherhood.
That was a bomb blast. Yeah. Certainly lit things
How
up.
How did, I mean, tell us, up until that point, what was the relationship like with your readership and the public?
Good. So I'd written two more books after the first one. I had, after kind of a bit of a not quite knowing what I was doing with the second book, I then wrote my third book, Country Life, that was a very idiosyncratic, strange, funny book that I absolutely loved, and I loved writing it, and I was really pleased with it. And I, you know, I don't know whether anyone else understood it or not, but you know, that was completely. Yeah, I did, and I thought I still think it's a good book. But then I had children, and that, I realized immediately that I could do one of two things. I could carry on writing books like The Country Life as though, you know, these other things weren't happening in my life, which I think is what a lot of women writers do, perfectly sensibly. Or I could keep trying to reflect the reality of these new, unknown, occasionally completely overwhelming and traumatizing experiences. And that was, it felt like there was no choice. I thought, okay, the novel form as I've come to use it, there is no place in it for, it can't do this. It can't do what I want it to do. It can't describe these experiences. It can't talk about these emotions. And I guess that was the beginning of a thinking process that literally took me pretty much 15 years to work out, and that ended with the trilogy, because I thought, okay, the answer is to write two different kinds of book and to use the memoir form to try to, you know, track these, you know, pretty much unrecorded to a degree, you know, aspects of female experience, and then, you know, to write novels separately to that. And you know, the problem with that was that the sort of, I suppose, pinning or blaming on the author, the memoir is completely exposed to that. You are saying I, you are, and for me the I was something I just used. I used myself as a theoretical I in that form, you know, to do what I wanted to do. And I didn't anticipate, I guess, that identification would be taken much, much further. But, you know, without quite realizing it, I was very naively sort of lifting the lid on a great cauldron of taboo and ambivalence and, you know, defensiveness and indeed some sort of untruth telling that has its roots, you know, so far into female history that you know, it was never going to be unless I had repeated things that people wanted to hear that made them feel better in themselves as mothers. You know, that I was never going to get through that without experiencing aggression.
And motherhood is such a terrifying thing to write about, not only
Not only because people don't like to hear the unpalatable truth, but it can be so easily be dismissed. I remember when I went on maternity leave, I was asked if I was going to become a mummy blogger. Just the it's hard to write about without being very, very aware of everything that has been written before that and that it can descend into cliche. But were you driven by this sort of urge to write about the things that no one speaks of?
I mean, I remember being quite surprised when sort of male people and probably some female people too in you know, the literary world, insofar as I was, you know, conversant with it in those days, thinking that it was, or sort of expressing their view that it was beneath a literary writer to write about these things, and that it was not only a non-intellectual but almost a sort of anti-intellectual thing to do. And, you know, so one is kind of strung between these two, you know, one reads Adrienne Rich and, you know, sort of feminist writers who've you know, tried to kind of build some narrative structure around motherhood, and they are so clearly writing from kind of behind the barricades, if you see what I mean, or from, you know, from the other side of a sort of trench war, and then this sort of literary world, which, you know, all of my aspirations were literary aspirations. Literature was what I cared about. Literary art was what I cared about. If I felt any sort of ambitions or kind of, I don't know, determination in myself, it was to be a better writer, to be a better literary writer. And so, you know, how did these two things connect with each other? On the one side, it's demeaning, it's beneath you, you will, I was told this very firmly, that I would sort of stigmatize myself, as it were. I would mark myself down if I wrote about these things. And yet on the other side, a clear feminist call to, you know, use my abilities as a writer to illuminate, you know, some of the realities of this subject. Luckily I only half thought about it. I just sort of automatically did it. And I mean,
didn't you write it in the mess of like, were you like, didn't you have a 1-year-old and you were pregnant with the,
yes,
the second, yeah. Well, that just,
yeah,
I don't know how you, like, the physical, how you carved that time out is just mind-blowing. Did you do it at 2 a.m?
No, I write very quickly, which is lucky.
Okay.
I think, and I mean, I've, you know, my writing style adapted pretty quickly to having children, because I, you know, there was no way I was going to give either of those things up, and there was no way I was going to compromise either of them. And that's pretty much remained the case. And so you know, my work needs to be fed by reality. And so actually, other than sheer physical exhaustion, the reality of pregnancy, of small children, you know, was helpful to me. I guess in a way it would have been helpful to a painter who's trying to paint it. You know, there it was right in front of me.
So it reads that way.
It's kind of easy to sort of, and I suppose I didn't, you know, my feeling of objectivity, which was what I really trained myself to feel as a literary writer, was actually really useful in the writing of autobiography, because, you know, I knew that I knew absolutely that it really, really didn't matter what was mine, what I felt, what was personal to me. You know, the only thing that mattered was being able to see what was universal in this experience, and what, in terms of what I had in front of me as materials, what I could use to create that universality. And I guess, I mean, you know, another sort of feature of that time was just amazing numbers of hours spent lying awake at night, unable to get back to sleep, in which I think I really worked out. I've always done a lot of thinking at that time, and I really worked it out. I worked out a lot of stuff about how I could take this most personal of experiences, so personal that I think pretty much every single woman on this planet who has a baby feels somewhere inside herself that no one has ever done that before, and that she is the first person ever to see. And that is completely how it feels. And to get from that to a place of objectivity was a big leap.
Well, speaking of universality, I just want to touch on aftermath and the aftermath of aftermath, because really I in some ways I can understand there are taboos around motherhood and there are things that you don't say, supposedly. But aftermath is an account of your divorce. And it's based on a pretty universal premise in that divorce sucks. So were you...
Yeah. You would have thought no one would disagree with that, but somehow they did,
But somehow they did. Were you... You must have been taken by surprise by that absolutely vitriolic reaction.
I suppose I think that perhaps this was a minefield that had been laid back in the time of a life's work, and that there was a willingness... To because in fact A Life's Work became quite an acceptable book quite quickly, and the anger about it turned into, I guess, a sort of grudging recognition that it was quite helpful, you know, to have this out there, to have this, you know, but only for those very strange women who, you know, aren't enjoying having a baby, you know, but let's, you know, they're allowed to have their book about not enjoying having a baby. Yeah. So I think that there was a kind of a backlash in waiting, or a re-backlash, because it's not like there was ever a great approval of you know, my work, and it was all about the children. It was all of the backlash, I think, pretty much. I tried not to swallow too much of that poison, but it was about violating privacy. And, you know, this is the area that, you know, I have had to think about how, about cruelty, really, that people's cruelty hiding behind these ideas of not telling the truth, really, of there being some reason to do with privacy, why you're not allowed to tell the truth. And you know, that is a big, stubborn block in human existence, that particular attitude, and it always has been. And I think it's easy. I made an easy target of myself by trying to say something about what divorce might be like for children, trying to imagine something of that. And again, you know, trying very, very hard not to, you know, in fact, that book has very little of my reality in it, very little about my own, you know, actual boring humdrum life. And that nearly finished me off, that particular experience.
I've read somewhere that you said that in the wake of that, you had to rip yourself up. What did that entail?
Yeah, this is not working. This is not working.
And so how, obviously, that informed your approach to the Outline trilogy, and you had no interest in returning to the conventional novel, and you, in effect, with these books, sort of turned your technique inside out in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Did you know that you were onto something when you were writing it? Did it feel like it was working?
Well, I think actually, you know, when, because in fact, Aftermath has become very acceptable in maybe not in the UK, but definitely in other places. It's had a lot of it has a readership, and I mean it's been published much later in those places, and I think part of the reason for that, and it's particularly attracted the attention of certain kinds of artists, and so I think the reason for that is that I think I made some kind of breakthrough in style in Aftermath that then allowed me to write the trilogy. But I just didn't know it at the time. It just felt so unbelievably painful, you know, what was said about it, what had happened, the consequences for my family. It was absolutely horrendous. And there, you know, there was this breakthrough somewhere in there. And so I think when it came to trying to imagine a new literature for myself, the link was with that book, with Aftermath, and the feeling that was so hard for me to remember once the reaction happened. It was so hard for me to remember the different kind of pleasure that I had felt writing that book, and the feeling of advance in my own craft that I felt, and a freedom, which is partly what the book is about. It's about breaking up conventional structures and trying to find a new kind of freedom. And indeed, you know, when I thought about it, I thought, well, that was what I felt writing it. So that sort of made sense. So I think by the time I got to outline, I not only had zero expectation of the world or what it might think about what I was doing. I guess I also felt much freer, and I thought, I don't care if nobody understands this. And when I wrote outline, I thought, no one is going to understand this, and that's a shame. So I really did sort of look at it and think, oh no, I did that.
So you didn't really, you had no idea that it would be received in the way that it was, but no. It was a leap of faith to think that people would get it, I guess, would get what you were trying to do.
I didn't think they would get it, but when I thought about it, it was a bit like, you know, you can spend your whole life reading warnings on cigarette packets saying smoking gives you lung cancer and you can still smoke, and then you get lung cancer and you think, why didn't I, you know, do what it said on the packet of the thing? You know, it was clear cause and effect. And I think that putting myself in a different position, which I was very conscious of doing that in outline, and of thinking, I don't like this, it doesn't feel, it's not what I want to do. All of my instincts are not to do that, but it was a sort of mental, technical almost realization that I just kept having to discipline myself to remain, you know, to stay in this place, not in that place. And so I think the end result was that I didn't know what my book was going to do, because I'd obeyed different rules in writing it. And that in fact, those rules were all about not existing as a subjective target in the text in the same way, which is what I had realized had gone wrong in my work in the past, and it worked. So when people read it and sort of went, wow, you know, we like this, I thought, oh, that's what happens when you follow this particular rule. But I couldn't at all sort of see that or understand that, or so it felt like a very technical change, not a change in my heart or in my experience of writing, just a decision about how this was going to look.
Yeah, because in a way you're touching on the same sort of themes, you're exploring the same sort of ideas, but this narrator Faye is almost like a human shield or a disguise or a, you know, a suit of armor, so that the very truths that drew so much ire in those memoirs were then lauded in this trilogy. Was that a kind of galling in a way?
Sort of yes, in a way. I mean, rather as I've just attempted to describe, the feeling of applying a formula, which, you know, is, there's nothing wrong with that, because you know, one's job or role or you know, is to develop as an artist, not to develop as an ego, not to stay more, you know, more and more yourself and write the same book over and over again because that's the book that people like. You know, it's development, and sometimes that development is not offered to you by life, by the things that happen. And indeed, very often life discourages artistic development. So, you know, it thinking and working things out and coming up with formulas and is a legitimate form of development, I guess. It just feels artistically, it feels like it shouldn't be like that, but it very much is like that. And so I guess that, you know, I so remember particularly the initial stages of writing outline. It was like learning a new language, where I kept having to sort of look things up and like, hang on, let me just remember what it is I've worked out about sentences that I've just gone back and written an old sentence, and I have to see why that is and write a new sentence. And so it didn't feel galling so much as that I realized I'd done something quite difficult, and that writing had been like, I don't know, climbing a sort of icy mountain in a storm on my own, and that I'd kept at it and kept at it, kept at this formula. And so I suppose I thought, you know, well done to myself a bit for that.
I'm glad you allowed yourself that.
At last, yeah. Just the once.
Yeah, just the one. A pat on the back. Perhaps sort of the most pressing concern of the outline trilogy is, well, or an element that stands out so much is that this, it consists primarily of people relating their own stories, but it's related through Faye. So Faye also creates her own narrative by assembling other people's stories and the way that she shapes those narratives. I'm interested in this concept of narrative and people's voices and how that applies to the debate at the moment around who gets to speak, and where you fit into that conversation as an established writer. And do you feel entitled to continue to speak or to take up space?
No, not at all. And whenever I say that, to, you know, writer friends or they're just like, what? So I think other people don't feel this as much as I do. I think a lot of writers feel that if they have succeeded in writing and publishing work, that is a kind of legitimacy in itself, whereas I definitely don't think that. I guess the worry I have is that, in fact, the very things that I describe in second place, this extremely unstable terrain of mature femininity, that it might actually be slipping into that kind of thinking. That I'm just like, oh, shut up, no one cares what you think anymore. which is, I suppose, how I do speak to myself.
Whereas for a male artist, it's a cumulative thing where they are allowed to kind of accumulate this experience and this output over the years. And for the middle-aged woman, it's like we are constantly reinventing ourselves or starting from the ground up. But that's not where that comes from you, is it, in terms of, you know, that conversation around taking up space? What's at the center of it, do you think?
Well, I mean, stunningly, I've encountered not one but many male writers and artists who feel and express extreme anger about the idea that their voices might be in question. Real anger And I mean, that's, you know, part of that has gone into second place in the anger the artist feels at certain identities having a greater value than the white male getting on a bit identity. And I'm afraid to say that, you know, an object value has been attached to feminine identity since time immemorial, and that object value is as a sexual object or as a domestic object, and that has been attached to women by men. And so, you know, there is no basis for objecting to identities being given an object value, you know, end of argument. And so it is very much an attempt to have it both ways. But, you know, that real anger at the idea of something being taken away from you as though it was a law that nothing could ever be taken away from you. It's been a long time coming, but the conversation needs to be had. And, you know, all I think is that I would never stand in the way of that conversation. And yet I can't imagine or see how I would help but that would be very wrong if that wasn't true. If in fact there was something helpful that I could say or be in the light of that, it would be wrong for me not to say and be it. So it's something that I think about a lot. And we definitely live in a world where too much is said, possibly about, you know, too many things. And so to add to that, you know, the language economy feels very, very sort of busted at this point, and it's a funny medium, and also a frightening, you know, the consequences for saying the wrong thing, for instance. You know, I mean, I'm pretty used to that, and I mean, I would never say anything outside the covers of a book, really, anyway. You know, in the forms of social media, which I, you know, am pretty admiring of, but I would never dare to or think of using those. So it's a pretty thorny area.
Is that why, in the context of all that thinking, you liken second place to restoring an old building? Is that your way of taking up less space?
It absolutely does. No, I think it's not only taking up less space, it's thinking, okay, if I go back and use an abandoned form, an old form, you know, that form was created in conditions that pre-existed, obviously, the conditions of now. And so that there's a knowledge of how to create that can't really do violence or harm in the now. Just like, you know, London's full of old buildings and they're nice. They, you know, they are what London is. And so you can't go, that's a really horrible building. Someone builds a new building and you go, that's a really horrible building. They've wrecked it, you know. So I think I felt that there was a structural or aesthetic correctness that you sort of couldn't go wrong with. You know, even though I'm sure every attempt would be made to suggest that you had gone wrong. But that's how it felt to me.
Well, safe to say we will continue to reserve space on our bookshelf for all your future books, Rachel, and I hope you can keep justifying them to yourself. Thank you so much for making time for us to chat.
Thank you. Thank you.
And you can make sure that you purchase Rachel's books. They're available for sale through that bookshop web page, and the books are sold by our bookshop partner, Readings. Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in to the Melbourne Writers Festival.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.